subacute beds for people going through crisis, like people in James Chassie's situation. And that, could you talk about that, the need for that, and what happened with that? And,
you know, I'm not familiar with the funding for that and where that status is. I do know that if you're looking at the status of mental health and people in mental health crisis on the street, it is just tremendous. We have a program called the Unfunded 20, where we take folks that are cycling through the jail that have chronic mental illness, and because they're uninsured, they may qualify for a very short period of time until they get stabilized with the Verity Plus program with the county. But then once they get stabilized, then they no longer can access their medications and their therapy and so what happens is that we need options, just like everyone else that has dropped off the Oregon Health Plan. The mentally ill have dropped off the Oregon mm-hmm. Health Plan as well. And psychiatric medicine and medications can be extremely expensive, $400 a month for a medication. And so if what we're finding is we're seeing more and more people that can't access mental health care because they are not insured, and they can't get stabilized because they can't get their medication. And so I think we can only expect that situation to get worse.
Could you explain, you mentioned that the Taft took in folks who were insured, who were very low income, but they had OHP standard, and that resulted in funding directed to the safety net overall. Can you explain that so that a layperson could understand?
Yeah,
that
basically.
Multiplier effect?
Yeah, basically we got a grant, a small grant, to help cover some of the cost of the Taft. We used some of the money for covering the beds about half the beds. The budget would have been able to be satisfied if two out of the four people in the Taft were covered by Oregon Health Plan. What happened is that we would have had enough money to then spread the load and also help pay for the uninsured in those beds, because we're doing it pretty economically. But it became harder and harder to get folks that were actually insured. And so as that number decreased, we just did not have the money to match it. And it just became a losing proposition. And just was money just coming straight out of the county budget to try to house a relatively small number of people who are in desperate straits.
It's interesting. It seems like this whole conversation, beyond the underlying theme of people at the lowest income feel the greatest brunt of societal breakdown, as you were, and I would call the lack of access to healthcare societal breakdown. It's very interesting. It's great that the hospitals around town would step up in this gap, but boy, how many times do we need to pay for stuff on the back end? I mean, the hospital's motivator of stepping up is great, but the reality is those are costs the hospital has to pay, which then get passed on.
Actually, it's good that you brought that up, because if you think about it, in this way, the hospitals, by funding the recuperation care program, we're getting somebody out of the hospital a lot sooner than if we didn't. So that's freeing up a bed that they can bring in a potentially insured patient. So they're not only losing less money by getting somebody out of the hospital into us, aside from doing just a generally good thing, but they're also opening them up to the opportunity to bring in somebody who will make them money.
But I think what my point was going to be, and I do think that's good, it's sort of like that car commercials that Ron Tonkin or whatever talks about volume. And, you know, when you have health care for everybody and there's a bigger pot of people covered, then there's a greater ability to do programs that would focus on the low income. Prevention, exactly. But when you have to do it on the back end, and it's great that the hospitals are stepping up, even if they do have their own motives, it's a super thing they're doing. But boy, it just seems to me, why are we doing this on the back end?
That's right. Well, the critical. I just wanted to mention too that that part of our program at the county is we are starting or have started a mobile medical clinic that goes throughout the county. And the target of that program was originally to see homeless families and at-risk families. But what we're seeing is a large number of low-income, uninsured, working individuals and families that can't get health insurance and are working. I mean, over 50% of the folks that are uninsured are working. I think it's 57%. So, you know, it's what we're seeing is just a tremendous trend towards people getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And what we found is that a lot of those folks don't even go into the hospital. They don't because they can't pay for it. They choose not to go to the health clinics. They choose not to go to the hospitals. They stay home and they become sicker and sicker and sicker. And by the time that they have an opportunity like the medical van, then they are really sick. I mean, cancers and advanced diabetes, et cetera, because they didn't have the money. It's just throwing money away as well as quality of life.
Mm. Yeah, that's a powerful image. I'm wondering, where do the people go who can't get into convalescent beds? They're discharged by the hospital. Where do they go? Do they just sort of wander off and invisibly disappear? What happens with them?
They get sicker. I mean, we saw a person at the, we were at the Harvest dinner last year. We saw a person that had been discharged from the hospital, didn't have a place to go, and he had an infection or MRSA in his legs, and he had not been able to get care for that, and it had been a couple months since he'd gotten care, and as a result, he... by the time we took the bandages off and looked at his legs, they were much, much worse condition. He went right back to the hospital. So we find people because our nurses go out to the streets and we see people through the homeless van, through the medical van, et cetera, who just they get discharged. And a lot of times they get discharged with prescriptions in hand, but no medication because there isn't any money for medication, and lives don't improve. Their visit to the hospital didn't benefit them in that regard, and they just become sicker and sicker.
Right,
you see them on the street.
This is a huge problem. As we start to wind down, what sort of solutions do you all envision? What would you like to see if you could afford it, if the legislature supported funding for it? Corey, I'd like to ask you, what would you like to see as far as the homeless are always going to be with us, unfortunately, but...
I have to say, outside of, expanding and opening up the Oregon Health Plan, expansion of respite programs like the RCP,
mm-hmm.
Certainly the more volume that we can take in, the more of these homeless that we can help. You mentioned the individuals with the MRSA infections. Those are probably among the most vulnerable out there, who need care. And with them having, need for these intense antibiotics, they're not going to get that anywhere else except for in a respite program or a skilled nursing facility. And so expansion of that type of program, like respite care, is what they need.
Do you anticipate just slowly increasing the number of beds that you're going to have? Or what do you?
We haven't done that slowly yet. Every increase has been in leaps. As each mm-hmm. hospital system mm-hmm. adds on or expands, as they realize what we're doing and how good it's benefiting everybody, we expand by leaps and bounds, and I predict that that'll continue into the future.
I'm curious. In 2001, I had an infected foot. I was out on the street. I went to Providence, and the social worker there, the discharge person, mm-hmm. got me a place in an inexpensive motel for a week where I could keep the foot lifted and it could
sure,
repair.
Keep it clean,
and I had
get
antibiotics
a shower, yeah.
and just let it cure. And has that been absorbed by the RCP?
Absolutely.
Okay.
They're doing that too, because like you say, there's a lot of these homeless out here, and our capacity right now is 21 beds. That's 21 individuals at a time. We're certainly getting the worst of them. We're getting the ones that need us the most. But you get this individual that has an infected foot that needs some attention, that needs some wound care. We're going up, we're assessing them, we're coming up with plans, and we're bringing them into RCP, and we're giving them 30 to 45 days, plus primary care at Old Town Clinic, plus the hospitals are providing a full 30-day supply of medications, not just the scripts. They're actually coming up with 30 days worth of meds, the antibiotics they need. That gives us at the clinic time to get them onto medical scholarship programs so that even when those meds, if they have chronic meds, they'll now get, you know, free or low-cost meds ongoing.
And is this just to, again, we don't have too much more time here, but I am very interested because I think this is it's a great solution in the vacuum that we have and to have the hospital stepping up. Is this something where Central City drove this process, sort of came up with the idea and approached the hospitals, or did they?
Actually, no. Actually, this was Ed Blackburn of Central City Concern and Debbie Lamberger of OHSU. The two of them were meeting and already discussing some other things they had going on. And Debbie Lamberger brought up, you know, some patients we had in common. Here's some issues we're having. These, you know, repeat ER visits, extended length of stays, you know, this is a problem. What can we do about it? Let's work together on this. And they came up with this great idea based on some previous programs that we had, like the community engagement program and Old Town Safe Passage Beds. Mm-hmm. And so they took those ideas and they developed this RCP model. And this is what's become of it.
Are you working with the VA?
Not yet, but they'll be, their phone will be ringing.
Yeah, good.
And Kim, what do you see as the, going back to Jay's question, what do you see, what would be on your wish list if we could begin to envision a better way to offer care?
Well, again, I think the model that we had with the Taft was contingent on having a stronger Oregon health plan system. And I think, again, that the models that we've got between Central City and the county were two different models. From our standpoint, if we look at the big picture, strengthening the Oregon Health Plan, the measure on the ballot in November, is potential to not only help children but help a certain number of adults as well.
And that's Measure
50.
Measure 50. So yes on 50.
Healthy kids. Yeah. How would that help? Would that release money that would otherwise go to the children to be used to address health needs of older folks?
Well, I think the more people that we get that are insured, both adults and children, the better. You know, we see a lot I keep stressing that it's great to insure kids, but you've also got to insure their parents. We see an awful lot of families where the parents aren't insured, and as a result, the family is homeless. A lot of accidents or injuries that have resulted in then depression that follows or whatever can put a family of, you know, a family out on the streets very quickly. So I really am interested in seeing an expansion in children's health insurance, but I don't think we can really forget the adults in this as well. We've got lots of people in need and that are very desperate and not getting the kind of services. So for me, the number one is trying to get an expansion of the Oregon Health Plan, open it back up, and let's get these people back insured.
Well, George Bush has the emergency room, and the homeless in Portland have Project Connect. shall we close with a remark about Project
Okay. Yes, thanks, Jay. Just wanted to let people know that on September 18th, there is a Project Homeless Families Connect. This is targeted for homeless families and families at risk of being homeless. A wide variety of services that will be there, including medical services, pretty extensive medical services, vision services, dental care, haircuts, legal services, benefits. Jay's laughing because he has a crew cut right now. But just a wide variety of services. It's going to be at the Convention Center this time. In the past, it's been the Coliseum, so the Twin Towers Convention Center. And it will be actually opening at 11 a.m. and closing at 7 to accommodate families both before and after school. And so I really am hopeful that people will take advantage of it. This isn't kind of a fair kind of a thing. This is actually services that are provided at the site and linking people to care that they can continue to get. So we hope that people will show up in force.
And Kim, if you, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but if you have a number, we have a lot of listeners out here, and some of them may have participated or volunteered at a Homeless Connect before. If you're looking for a little thing you could do to help make a difference, I'm sure there's still some need for some help down there.
Yeah, and I think that I haven't talked to the volunteer coordinator recently, but I think they are especially looking for people to help volunteer in the afternoon.
Good.
What I would advise you to do for more information is to call 503-823-2392 or visit www.portlandhomelessconnect.com.
Portlandhomelessconnect.com.
Right.
All right. Well, our man Sean should be ready to cue the music. Thank you very much for coming in and talking about respite care, the options available, and what we still need. And this is KBOO 90.7 on your dial, Hole in the Bucket, and we will be right back with the second half of our program.
Show what you really are. It's the same kind of scars. I'm looking at you, all I see is you're waiting for something single file. You'll murder my, you idiot kid. Got a death in it. You're choking up, take this paper cup, but there's a price that you'll pay. Trying hard to become whatever they are, saying whatever they say. So help yourself to this bitter pill, or somebody else will. Single file, you're a murder by, you idiot kid. Got a death in it. Single file, single file, single file, single file.
Welcome back. This is Jay Thiemeyer. This is KBOO's homeless show, Hole in the Bucket. I'm with Mike Anderson, the other co-host. We welcome him back from Togo. And the second half of the show is dealing with the Medford Three. We're talking with Patrick Nolan, who's the community organizer at Crossroads Community Organizing Project at Sisters of the Road Cafe, and Adam Arms, a local attorney who has dealt with homeless issues, poverty law. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Adam, I'd like to ask you about the Medford Three. Is that a rock group, or what exactly is that?
It's a group of homeless folks in Medford who were incarcerated, not for being charged with any sort of a crime, but because they were witnesses to an alleged crime. They were a group of folks who allegedly witnessed a homicide down near Medford, and subsequently a district attorney who was prosecuting the case filed some paperwork with the court, and the judge issued a material witness order incarcerating the three until trial. And so these were three homeless folks that were kept in jail for over 2 months and were never charged with a crime.
How common is it to have a material witness decision or verdict laid on by a judge? Is that something that happens often?
It's pretty rare. It happened. I think each state has its own version of the material witness law, and there's a federal law. It happens fairly rare, although after looking into this case and just doing a quick Google search in August, the same sort of thing happened in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where a homeless individual saw or allegedly saw a crime and was held in jail. And then eventually he was put under house arrest under the material witness statute. It is fairly rarely used, but just anecdotally, it seems like it's happening a little bit more, and especially with homeless folks. And I don't know why. If I were to speculate, I would say that maybe it's because this federal or the Bush administration's practice of incarcerating folks without charge and then whittling away habeas corpus rights is seeping down to the local level. I mean, it's got the same sour smell to it. You know, you've got somebody in jail who has not committed a crime, who's not charged with committing a crime, but judges are just seeming to keep people in.
Do you really think then that the dismissal of, say, habeas corpus and basic rights is sort of creating a mood in the legal community that people like, apparently these people down in Medford, the prosecutor and this compliant judge, just felt that this was, you know, there wasn't going to be anybody standing in their way. These were homeless folks, that they literally could do this and get away with it?
I think so. It's pure speculation on my part, but I think when you've got the federal judges and the presidential folks doing the same thing, I think it emboldens the local judges and local law enforcement to do the same. It's just got that it smells bad, and it smells the same as what's going on at the federal level.
Right. Well, there were several constitutional rights that were just trampled on, like search and seizure. Their property was seized or was lost. I mean, just total disrespect. The detention was indefinite, I assume, as long as the case, theoretically, that as long as the case was open, they would be held.
That's correct.
So who found out about this and how? Tell us about the response, how that developed.
Well, the local media picked up on it, and there was a story. I forget the name of the local newspaper, but they ran a story.
The Mail Tribune.
A Mail Tribune, you're right, and it hit the wire. Paul Bowden, the director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, emailed me about it. I contacted the local attorneys down there, and it just seemed to kind of pick up steam. When the more people heard about it, the more people were outraged about it. There were, I think the Mail Tribune ran a good editorial about the outrageousness of this, but it did kind of pick up steam, and there's a lot of credit that should be given to the attorneys that were appointed to the homeless folks who are incarcerated. You know, by state law, if you're held under material witness order, you have the right to counsel, and so they were appointed free legal representation, folks who do public defense down in the Medford area. And they really made a lot of noise and spearheaded the effort to get these folks out. There were, I think, three hearings in total trying to convince the judge to let these folks free, which eventually he did to some extent.
I'm curious what the editorial of the Mail Tribune focused on as far as their outrage. Do you recall the specific things? I mean, was it the indefiniteness of it? What specifically?
I think it was the same response that most people have when they hear the story. It's just outrage that the courts can hold somebody without charge indefinitely. And particularly in this case, I think the outrage was centered around the fact that the judge's decision seemed to really be based on the fact that these folks were homeless. The judge focused on two general issues. One, the homelessness of the individuals, the homeless status. And two, the judge focused on allegations that these folks were not cooperative with with police, that when they allegedly saw this purported crime, that they did not run directly to the police and say, hey, come on over, something happened. You know, and my personal outrage partially comes from the fact that the judge did not seem to understand the relationships of homeless between homeless folks and the police. I mean, you've got, in general, the police are not friends of homeless folks. I mean, they, for one reason or another, you know, they're given orders, or it's kind of their modus operandi. The police will harass homeless folks. It just, it happens. And so for a judge to come in and say, oh, you did not go directly to the police and confide in them about what allegedly happened, it's frustrating. And it's clear to me, from what I know about the case, that the judge just didn't understand that relationship between the police and homeless folks, and didn't understand and doesn't understand homelessness in general. I mean, the judge, I'm again speculating a little bit here, but focusing just on the fact that these folks were homeless, that's not enough, and those are part of the constitutional arguments that we made. I mean, the judge did not seem to understand that you can be homeless and be a resident of a true resident of the community and part of the community, and have a place to get mail and have a place to get phone messages, and can be a person who can make regular court dates. It just seemed the judge turned off when he heard homeless, and just made a lot of assumptions and made his decision accordingly.
All right. What underlies both segments of tonight's program is the human rights of homeless folks, whether it's regarding health care and the need for respite care if you have an emergency crisis and you're homeless, or basic human rights as far as treatment by the law. And what did the judge say when he finally released these people? What did he acknowledge?
Well, like I said, the defense attorneys who represented these folks did a lot of work on getting these folks released. They made legal arguments, but they also, behind the scenes, worked out a release plan where the folks would be released to a shelter and would engage in some type of monitoring and regular checking in until the case went to trial or otherwise resolved. So the judge based his decision not on any constitutional arguments that we made, but on the fact that there was some sort of a release plan put in place.
Release plan recognize their constitutional rights, or did they have to like report like school children on periodically during the day? And you know, what kind of provisions were?
I understand that they were to stay in a shelter. They had to check in with the probation department. I don't know if it was daily or semi-weekly or weekly, but they had to regularly check in.
As though they had charges on them, but they didn't.
It's similar to where a person is charged with a crime and can't make bail, but there's just not enough to support keeping them in jail. So a judge will release them conditionally and set forth some standards, reporting standards, checking in, usually with a probation department or a pretrial release program. So it's just about the same as if they're charged with a crime and awaiting trial themselves.
And this can go on indefinitely, as long as the case is open.
As long as the case is open, that's right.
Potentially year or that's amazing. That kind of attitude is similar to the dismissal of homeless in Portland, and I'm thinking of I'm looking at Patrick Nolan, thinking about the sit-lie ordinance, which basically is just trying to appear as though they care about homeless, but in reality is just trying to please the business community. Is that safe to say, Patrick?
I would say that everybody on the Safe Oversight Committee is trying to represent their community as best as possible. I wouldn't say I don't think anybody went directly with the attitude that we're gonna see what we could, you know, how we can hose someone. But while representing your community, oftentimes you do affect other communities.
And it, I guess really to me where it seems like there's that parallel strain is this assumption of second class status, this assumption that because of this classification of homelessness, certain things such as your habeas corpus rights, your access to health care, your ability to sit on a public sidewalk.
Or right to travel freely.
Yeah.
I would tend to agree that I see no reason for the city of Portland to have a sidewalk obstruction ordinance. Honestly, I've never met a person that was sitting on the sidewalk, including me while I was homeless, that wouldn't move if somebody asked. You know, if you're walking past somebody on the sidewalk and they're in your way, say, hey, you know, your legs are in my way. Can you move a little bit? I've never met anybody that wouldn't.
And the fact is that if a homeless person is being aggressive or threatening, that's addressed separately anyway. I mean, it has nothing to do with the sit-lie ordinance, which is just basically clean sweeping. It's sanitizing the city.
There are definitely laws against acting aggressively or anything else that, you know, would make it something other than just an issue of, you know, there being a blockage of the sidewalk.
Right. I'd like to know what else. You mentioned Scranton had a case that was somewhat like this. Can you, as we sort of get a larger picture, because obviously if this thing was did get people's attention and was addressed and was remedied to some extent, there must be an awful lot of other instances where police, I know in the South where I'm from, that the cops consider homeless in many cases, given the Bible Belt, literally as demonic, and that they are they have a blank check to do with whatever they want to. And in a situation like this, there would be nobody to stand up for them, or the people in the South who would stand up are so few and far between that there must be a lot of other instances. But one we know of is Scranton, I believe.
Right, and I think a lot of these go under the radar because, maybe they're not sexy news stories, or people just don't pay attention or don't care when a homeless person is incarcerated for no reason. And it's difficult. I think these cases are difficult to address through the legal system because while 1 to 6 months is a hell of a long time to be in jail, when you're not charged with a crime or not being convicted of any crime, the wheels of justice move fairly slow, and 6 months, 3 months is not really a lot of time to get a challenge together. We were scrambling to try to figure out how to do it, talking to criminal defense attorneys here in the area, and people were shaking their heads, saying, "Well, maybe you should try this, maybe you should try this." And I think we finally found a course of action, but the soonest we would have been able to get a higher court to overturn this decision would have been weeks down the line. I mean, it takes a while to address this sort of thing because you need to go over the heads of the local judges who makes this decision. So if you find out the first day somebody's incarcerated on a material witness warrant and you want to challenge it, you're not going to be able to get that person out for weeks or maybe months. These things are pretty hard to attack.
Right. I'm also connecting this with the fact that hate crimes against homeless are on the increase. I was reading a report from the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is Morris Dees and those folks, who pretty credible operation, and it's really scary. It's about the attitude that you can the homeless don't matter. You can pay them $5 and they'll beat each other to death, and that's all right. You take pictures of it and you sell the movies, and that's all right. And this dismissal of the humanity of people because they're out on the street dealing with a really horrible situation to begin with, and then it's excused because they did something to deserve it or they're not capable of any better, and they don't matter anyway.
Right. What do you expect when you have your local governments, for example, Portland, passing a law that's, really directed at homeless people, taking away their civil rights and human rights to exist in public? So you've got your local governments treating people as less than human beings, and that filters down, it filters around, and then people start thinking of homeless folks as not just second-class citizens, but as non-citizens who don't deserve respect or rights. And it's a vicious circle.
And I'm interested, Patrick, to hear your opinion. I've heard a lot about, I've never attended a SAFE committee meeting, but I've been following it certainly quite closely. And I've definitely, what you said earlier, something that I've heard a lot, which is that the participants on the SAFE committee, by and large, from their own understanding, are quote-unquote coming at it from a good place, that people are really sitting down and trying to say, we have these issues, we have this disagreement, let's try to get to it. At the same time, the result that's still coming out of it is something that, on its face of it, seems clearly unconstitutional to me. To talk a little bit about your perception of what, where the disconnect is coming.
When I was invited to participate in the SAFE Oversight Committee, it had already been decided before I was even told about it that there was going to be a sit-lie law. There was going to be a sidewalk obstruction law attached to this. It was going to be one of the four bases for this SAFE over ordinance, and I don't know if there was anything I could have done or anybody could have done differently to make it not happen. I do question that once in a while. You know, is there something I could have done differently so we wouldn't have this law? Past that, I think that we're just looking at a lot of different people approaching this table from a lot of different perspectives. And like I said, sometimes the different perspectives don't mesh. You know, I come there representing people that have no other place to sit a lot of times. And there are
Patrick,
people.
Were you the only person representing homeless who had experienced homelessness at the table?
Another gentleman by the name of Neil Doner was at a lot of the early meetings or middle meetings. And Jenny Nelson from Sisters of the Road was there, but she's never been homeless, but she's been in the know for a good number of years. And there was representative from the advocate side of things. There were representatives and still are representatives from JOIN and Oregon Law Center, New Avenues for Youth, and a few other groups that are escaping me at the moment.
I guess as a citizen here, taxpaying citizen, I look at my government and I wonder about these unfulfilled promises. I see the same thing with affordable housing. You know, we talk about the Pearl or the South Waterfront, and there are these promises of a certain percentage, a certain number of units, a certain space being devoted to affordable housing. And you look at what they actually do, and it's always just, way short of the mark. And the assumption seems to be that you know, we can promise them whatever we want. If we give them anything, they'll be grateful. And the same thing with the homeless, with the sit-lie ordinance, that if we promise them benches, we promise them expanded hours at night watch, if we get close to it or we do enough that we can point to, then that'll be enough to sort of satisfy them and keep them from getting too agitated. And the same dismissive attitude, I guess that really concerns me, because if you've ever experienced homelessness, you realize that it's really difficult to see yourself demonized. It's difficult to survive the indignity. I mean, the fact that you are considered by most people as having done something to deserve your situation, that you're subhuman, and that you'll never be, you know, like, say, a person who is socially or civically minded, you know, a pillar of the community. And so whatever you get, if you get anything positive, you ought to be grateful and be quiet. So I'm glad that we've been addressing the fact that there are people who are standing up, but the problem is huge. And I think it's really interesting that, like, the treatment of the people in Gitmo and Abu Ghraib, that illegal detention, just the whole illegality of that is sort of striking, you know, determining, setting a mood, a tone, that seems to translate down to how we treat homeless folks, whatever it is, just denying fundamental constitutional rights, like the right to travel freely. Sit-lie, that's so to me, it's just on the face of it, it's bogus. It's the reverse of what people should be doing, namely pushing for affordable housing, health care for all these things. There should be this provision to address our human rights to health, to housing, et cetera. And instead, we're into demonizing and criminalizing people who are vulnerable and in need. So there's my sermon, and we've got a couple more minutes.
Well, and I think actually I'd like to shoot it back over to Adam for a second, because I think he was touching on something that you were touching on there, which is that the sort of below all of this is, or above all of this, however you want to draw it, is the this whittling away of the rule of law, a concept that should stand free and above of any particular social impressions or ideas of this group or that group. I mean, it's this abstract principle that a lot of our society is absolutely fine. It's what we're exporting in Iraq, right? Talk a little bit about that more from a legal perspective and how that's troubling.
Well, America was founded on ideas of liberty and equality under the law. And for homeless folks, America has been failing to deliver for a long time. And the trend is continuing and perhaps getting worse. And I don't... It may be this flavor of whittling the way the Constitution from, that the Bush administration is doing, but it's filtering down, and the sit-lie ordinance is part of that, that you are taking away human and constitutional rights of citizens. And there are two levels. One is whittling away on the surface, attacking laws or passing laws that take people's rights away. And the other is the under-the-radar actions that police and other folks take. I'm concerned about the sit-lie law. I'm not so concerned about actual tickets being issued or consequences. I think that the enforcement of the above-the-water enforcement of this is not going to be as harsh and demeaning as the under-the-radar stuff, where police officer will go up to homeless folks who know about this law and are concerned about it, and the cops tell people to move along, and then you're moving people from one area of town to the other and then back again and back again, and violating people's rights to be in the community and not necessarily enforcing the law, but using it as leverage to further erode people's rights. And their humanity.
I'm curious. Is there any possibility? I know a person of means who had access to decent legal counsel would be in a position to bring suit for the actions of this judge and the prosecutor. But a homeless person does. Is there any possibility of a suit?
I think it would be fairly difficult for somebody to bring an action against a judge in this sort of a case. The facts would have to be, absolutely outrageous. And the way that the law is written in Oregon, I mean, we're making arguments that the law allows too much freedom on the judge's part and violates the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, because it doesn't require any kind of probable cause. The state law just says the judge has to have a reasonable belief that someone's not going to show up for trial. So,
Right. Is there any possibility of, say, the attorneys down around Medford of bringing some kind of complaint to the State Bar Association for this kind of behavior?
Again, I think the problem is with the law. The judge was, I think, doing what he was working within the wide boundaries of this law. I think that, the judge's decision is being appealed through the state courts, and so there may be some changes made to that law to rein it in a little bit. But the pretty much all you can do is hope that you get a good court-appointed attorney who's going to fight like hell for you, like these folks' attorneys did, and try to get you out. And then you can make collateral attacks on the law or try to get legislation passed that limits the law.
Well, we are... all of a sudden bucking up on the end of our time. It happens with every good show. I think Jay has one more question, then we'll thank you. And
Just very quickly, I was wondering, Adam, who you worked with locally to bring pressure on getting change down there?
In Medford?
And locally in Portland.
To help out the folks down in Medford?
Right, like the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center, for example? Or
you know, the Federal Public Defender's Office was extremely helpful. They forwarded on some research that they had done, and they have always been extremely helpful when I've asked for help. And I talked with a lot of different criminal defense attorneys in the area, and everyone was, first of all, outraged at what was happening, and second of all, very happy to help out.
Thank you.
Patrick, Adam, thank you very much for coming in and joining Jay and I. This has been Hole in the Bucket, your show on housing and homelessness. And, you know, all this stuff, the rights that we assume are ours and hope and cherish every day, they're only ours if we keep fighting for them. So do that. Keep struggling, because we're a long way from where we want to be. Good night from Hole in the Bucket, and tune in on October 10th, where we're going to talk more about this staggering number of homeless kids trying to get an education here in our state. Good evening.
Sleeping in their shoes, but there's a warning sign on the road ahead. There's a lot of people saying we'd be better off.
Hey, it's 7:01. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on.
This is the community calendar for Wednesday, September 12th. People's, Food Front, and Alberta's co-ops present the Cooperate for Community Contest, where you can nominate a person or group for their sustainable food initiatives and win funding for your favorite nonprofit. Check details at www.peoples.coop or call 503-232-9051. That's 503-232-9051. The deadline for entering nominees is this Friday, September 14th. Pub Quiz proudly presents the first ever Pub Quiz Tournament to benefit the Oregon Humane Society. This tournament runs from September 15th through the 17th and will take place over the course of the 3 days at Red Room, Biddy McGraw's, and Bridgeport Brewing Company, starting at 7 p.m. All proceeds from the tournament will benefit the Oregon Humane Society. The event is $20 per person. This entry fee includes a seat at the tournament, a tournament pint glass, and entry to the tournament social at Biddy McGraw's Thursday, September 13th. Teams of 4 to 6 players will compete in 4 rounds, accumulating points for every correct answer they score in each round of mixed trivia games from question and answer format to Name That Tune. Play to benefit the Oregon Humane Society and get a chance of winning prizes. Important, registration can be done online only. The address is pubquizoregon.com. That's pubquizoregon.com. The Metro Council hosted a series of public involvement activities in June for citizens to find out more about the regional acquisition program voters approved last November and share their priorities with the councilors. Thousands of citizens reviewed information about the Natural Areas Program and saw detailed maps of each of the 27 target areas at community open houses and on Metro's website. The Metro Council will finalize detailed acquisition plans at public meetings in September. The next meeting will be held Thursday, September 13th, 2 o'clock p.m. at the Metro Council Chamber. The address is 600 Northeast Grand Avenue in Portland. The